Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we take history's most complicated figures, dive into the definitive sources, and extract the knowledge you need to be truly informed.
And today, we are analyzing a life just defined by this unparalleled destructive force.
Both inside and outside the ring, we're talking about Michael Gerard Tyson.
Yeah, this is arguably one of the most essential deep dives we could do. Mike Tyson is so much more than a legendary boxer. He's, you know, a profound study in that tension between raw talent and self-destruction.
Our sources for this really cover his entire history. We're tracing this dramatic, almost chaotic arc from his childhood in Brooklyn all the way to his reign as the baddest man on the planet.
And then his eventual transformation into this, like, multimedia icon he is today.
So our mission today is really to unpack that duality. How does one person climb to the absolute peak of physical and professional achievement? We're talking one of the highest knockout to win percentages in heavyweight history. It's nearly 88%.
Wow, 88%.
And at the same time, navigate these continuous personal crises, controversies, and legal turmoil that just constantly threaten to derail everything.
And you have to establish that contrast,
that
brutal efficiency. Right from the start, before he was even 21, Tyson had already, you know, secured his place in history.
His first 19 professional fights, all knockouts.
All of them. And the truly astounding fact, 12 of those 19 fights didn't even make it past the first round.
12 first round knockouts right out of the gate. That's not just efficiency. That's a historical shockwave.
It is. And that combination of terrifying speed, accuracy, and power quickly made him the youngest boxer ever to win a heavyweight title.
He was only 20 years, 4 months, and 22 days old.
And all those accomplishments, delivered with that just ferocious style, they cemented his trio of iconic nicknames. Iron Mike, Kid Dynamite, and of course the one that really captured the public's imagination.
The baddest man on the planet.
You could argue that for a very brief, very terrifying period, that moniker was absolutely literal.
Okay, let's unpack the path that creates Kid Dynamite. Because his start in life was anything but golden, born Michael Gerard Tyson in Brooklyn, New York in 1966.
Yeah, his biography, it immediately introduces poverty and instability. He moved to Brownsville when he was about 10, a neighborhood that was, you know, known for high crime and just very few opportunities.
His early life was characterized by this deep, persistent lack of structure and a constant feeling of being threatened.
He developed this, like, hair-trigger temper, which was made so much worse by the fact that he was often mocked for his lisp and his high-pitched voice.
And that would instantly trigger fights.
Instantly. But the source material, it pinpoints this one specific catalyst for the fighting that is just, it's kind of heartbreaking in how simple it is.
His first fight wasn't over territory or turf.
No, it was against the bigger kid who pulled the head off one of Tyson's beloved pigeons.
That feels like a really crucial piece of biographical information.
It is. It shows that beneath this young street criminal, there was someone capable of this deep, intense emotional connection. And that the fighting, at least at first, it came from a place of defending something vulnerable that he loved.
But the legal system, they just saw a pattern, not a passion. He was repeatedly arrested for petty crimes and fighting, and the volume of it all is just, it's staggering.
The source material indicates that by the age of 13, he had been arrested 38 times.
38 times. That speaks to a system and a child really at a breaking point.
It does. And thankfully, that trajectory was broken when he ended up at the Tryon School for Boys. There, his raw, explosive ability was finally channeled.
Right. This is where Bobby Stewart comes in, a counselor and former boxer.
Exactly. Stewart took notice, and he realized he wasn't looking at some hopeless delinquent, but, you know, a rough diamond who just needed polishing.
And Stewart provided the essential connection. He introduced Tyson to Customato.
And this moment, it changes everything. D'Amato, the legendary trainer who would handle Floyd Patterson, he takes Tyson in. And when Tyson's mother died when he was 16,
D'Amato becomes his legal guardian.
He didn't just become a trainer. He became the moral, the intellectual, the emotional foundation that Tyson had lacked his entire life. He wasn't just teaching boxing. He was instilling a philosophy.
Tyson himself later reflected on his mother, saying, "She only knew me as being a wild kid running the streets, coming home with new clothes that she knew I didn't pay for."
Yeah. The tragedy is she never got to see the redemption that D'Amato provided.
And D'Amato and his assistant, Kevin Rooney, they were the architects of that redemption. They cultivated that unique and frankly intimidating peekaboo style.
Can you elaborate on that a bit? For those who aren't familiar, why was that style so devastating for a heavyweight?
Absolutely. The peekaboo style is all about supreme defense and calculated aggression. The hands are held high, really tight to the face, that's the peekaboo part, while the fighter constantly moves his head side to side.
Slipping and weaving the opponent's punches.
Exactly. And because Tyson was a bit shorter for a heavyweight, this style was perfected to let him close the distance safely.
So it completely neutralized the reach advantage that most heavyweights would have on him.
Precisely. But the offense, that was the true innovation. The explosive power in his hooks and his uppercuts came from this technique of crouching slightly before throwing the punch.
This is what engaged the powerful muscles in his legs, right? The spring, as the source calls it.
That's it. It transferred the maximum kinetic energy into the blow. It gave him this incredibly low center of gravity, which made him almost impossible to hit cleanly, while allowing him to just unleash devastating short-range power.
So it turned his perceived weakness, his height, into his greatest strength. It let him be fast and deadly on the inside.
His amateur success followed very quickly after that. Gold medals in the 1981 and 82 Junior Olympics, and his professional debut was just after his 18th birthday in March 1985.
He defeated Hector Mercedes via a first-round TKO.
But just 8 months later, that critical anchor in his life was just ripped away. Customato died in November 1985.
And the sources are, I mean, they're unified on this. They speculate that this was the most pivotal loss of Tyson's young life. It created this vacuum that was just never truly filled. D'Amato wasn't just training his body.
He was training his mind and his behavior.
Exactly. But without D'Amato, the professional train just kept moving forward with this relentless force, thanks to the momentum that D'Amato had already created.
In his first year, he had 15 professional bouts. Overall, he won 26 of his first 28 fights by KO or TKO.
With 16 of those ending immediately in the first round.
The sheer volume and the speed of those victories, it created this illusion of invincibility. But if you look closely at the records, you do find these surprising moments of vulnerability.
Yeah, Tyson himself cited a fight against Jose Ribalta in 1986. It went 10 rounds, ended in a TKO, but he called it his toughest early fight.
What stands out about that one? I mean, Ribalta wasn't exactly a world beater, yet Tyson felt he was the toughest.
It was a test of endurance, not skill. Tyson reflected that he hit Ribalta with absolutely everything, and Ribalta just took everything and kept coming back for more.
And Ribalta also connected with some hard body blows, right? I read that it left Tyson nauseous for hours after the fight.
It did. And the sources suggest that for Tyson, facing a man who simply would not fall, a true test of his stamina and durability, was psychologically and physically way more draining than just the quick, spectacular knockouts he was used to.
That's a great nugget. It connects his greatest distress not to a hard puncher, but to a durable opponent. And that dominance, it crescendoed to his first shot at a major title.
That's right. On November 23, 1986, he faced Trevor Burbick for the WBC Heavyweight Championship.
Burbick was dismantled. The fight ended via TKO in the second round. At 20 years old, he had done it. Youngest champion ever.
And the accolades were just immediate and astronomical. Donald Saunders, commenting on the state of boxing at the time, he suggested that the sport could cease worrying about its immediate future.
Because they had found a champion fit to stand alongside legends like Jack Dempsey, Joe Louis, and Muhammad Ali, he was just instantaneously history.
So once he had that WBC belt, the goal became comprehensive domination. He wanted to achieve undisputed status.
And for those who aren't familiar with boxing governance, we are talking about holding all three of the major sanctioning body belts at the same time, the WBC, the WBA, and the IBF.
And that quest for unification was just. It was executed with a military-like speed. In March 1987, he defeated James Smith by unanimous decision to add the WBA title.
Then, just 5 months later, in August 87, he beat Tony Tucker, also by unanimous decision, to claim the IBF title.
And this achievement made him the first heavyweight ever to simultaneously hold all three major belts.
Yep.
And the only heavyweight to successfully unify them in successive fashion.
The media quickly and, you know, accurately labeled this era Tyson Mania. He seemed untouchable, a global icon of destructive power.
He demonstrated this by continuing his reign, including a TKO victory over the 1984 Olympic gold medalist Tyrell Biggs in 1987. But the real statement of his generational dominance, that came in January 1988.
when he faced the legendary former champion Larry Holmes.
Holmes was a titan of the previous era, but Tyson didn't just beat him. He defeated him by TKO in the fourth round. He administered the only knockout loss Holmes would ever suffer in 75 professional bouts.
It was a clear passing of the torch, just executed via explosion.
And if the Holmes fight was the statement, the Michael Spinks fight was the definitive period on the sentence. On June 27, 1988, Tyson faced Spinks, who was the lineal champion and the ring champion.
This was set up to be the richest fight in history at the time.
Oh, the anticipation was immense.
Yeah.
The media billed it as this titanic battle of styles, the disciplined lineal champion versus the unstoppable wrecking machine.
The public expected a war.
But what they got was a massacre. Tyson vaporized Spinks. He knocked him out in just 91 seconds of the first round.
91 seconds.
And that 91-second obliteration is frequently cited by boxing historians as the absolute undisputed peak of Mike Tyson's professional career, physically, technically, and culturally. He looked perfect. He seemed unbeatable.
But what's so fascinating here is the timing. If that moment was his professional pinnacle, the personal foundation underneath him was already rapidly crumbling.
Oh, absolutely. The cracks in the armor were becoming gaping holes, and it was happening at the same time as that Spinks dominance. The public was fixated on his highly tumultuous marriage to actress Robin Givens.
The relationship was marked by extreme volatility, leading to these allegations of spousal abuse and mental instability on Tyson's part.
And this all became brutally public in September 1988 during that joint TV interview with Barbara Walters.
Right. Givens, sitting right next to Tyson on national television, described her life with him as torture, pure hell, worse than anything I could possibly imagine.
And this wasn't just celebrity drama. Givens also publicly stated that Tyson was manic depressive, a diagnosis that was later confirmed by doctors.
The dichotomy of the most physically dominant man in the world being described as emotionally unstable and violent by his own wife, right as he's achieving unification. It was just shocking to the public consciousness.
And they separated a few months later in February 1989.
And the professional team that had built him was disintegrating just as quickly as his marriage. After D'Amato's death, manager Bill Caton was gone. And critically, Tyson fired his longtime trainer, Kevin Rooney, in late 1988.
And this is where you see the immediate measurable impact of losing that guidance. Critics and boxing experts immediately noticed that after Rooney's departure, Tyson started showing significantly less head movement and combination punching.
He reverted to just relying on raw power. He was losing the technical brilliance of the peekaboo style.
Yeah, it's not just losing a friend. It's losing the specific instruction that made him so lethal. He still won his next few fights, like knocking out Frank Bruno in 1989, but the technical erosion was visible.
Which led to a noticeable lack of direction and less rigorous training by 1990.
And that set the stage for Tokyo. On February 11th, 1990, Tyson lost the undisputed championship to James Buster Douglas. This is still one of the most astonishing upsets in the history of global sport.
The betting lines tell the whole story, don't they? Tyson was a 42-1 favorite at one casino.
42-1. It's insane. The general feeling was that Tyson just hadn't taken the fight seriously. But Douglas, who was fighting after the recent death of his mother, he came prepared.
Technically, Douglas maximized his 12-inch reach advantage. He used that quick jab to keep Tyson on the outside and frustrated him.
And there was that controversy in the eighth round, which really highlights the chaos around Tyson's camp at the time. Tyson knocked Douglas down.
But his corner immediately complained that the count was slow, which they felt allowed Douglas time to recover.
Right. Douglas did recover and then proceeded to just batter Tyson heavily over the next few rounds.
And then the unthinkable happened in the 10th round. Douglas delivered this brutal uppercut followed by a four-punch combination. Tyson went down for the first time in his professional career.
And he was counted out. The undisputed title was gone.
It was such a shocking moment of failure for the public. But the duality of Tyson reviews itself again here. He later claimed that losing to Douglas was the greatest moment of his entire career.
That is a staggering claim. Why would the most humiliating moment be his greatest?
Well, because, as he stated, I needed that fight to make me a better person and fighter. He admitted that the loss forced him to gain a broader perspective on himself and on boxing.
So he recognized he'd become complacent, entitled, and was relying solely on fear rather than discipline.
Exactly. The defeat, paradoxically, was the only thing that could ground him.
So the narrative takes a very dark, sharp turn here.
Yeah.
Just as the world was processing this shocking defeat in the ring, the chaos, it just migrated entirely and far more gravely to the legal system.
Yeah. In July 1991, Tyson was arrested for the rape of 18-year-old Desiree Washington, who was Miss Black Rhode Island and a contestant at the Miss Black America pageant in Indianapolis.
The trial, which ran from January to February of 92, was, as you can imagine, a massive media spectacle. Washington provided this detailed testimony that Tyson picked her up, took her to his room, and forced himself on her.
She described him as mean, evil.
And the prosecution, they built a strong case with corroborating evidence. Crucially, Tyson's chauffeur, Virginia Foster, testified that she saw Washington in a state of shock afterward.
Even more damning, Foster provided testimony that Tyson had previously tried to sexually assault her. He lured her to his room, tried to touch her, and then exposed himself.
And this wasn't just eyewitness accounts. There was medical testimony. Dr. Thomas Richardson, an emergency room physician, testified that Washington's vaginal abrasions were consistent with assault.
He noted that in about 20,000 cases over 20 years, he'd only seen similar abrasions following consensual sex twice.
Tyson maintained full consent throughout the trial, but his defense was highly criticized. Lead counsel Vincent J. Fuller was accused of handling the case more like a first-year law student and making ill-fated decisions,
including failing to aggressively challenge certain inconsistencies in Washington's testimony.
So the outcome was conviction. On February 10th, 1992, Tyson was convicted and sentenced to 6 years in prison with 4 years of probation. He was released in March 1995 after serving just under 3 years.
And we really have to emphasize a significant lasting consequence here. Due to this conviction, Tyson is required to register as a Tier 2 sex offender under federal law.
And for context, Tier 2 registration requires the offender to update the registration information with law enforcement every 6 months for 25 years. This is a life-altering legal status that just runs parallel to his sports legacy.
So when he emerged from prison in 1995, he was ready to leverage his infamy. He was physically fit, but, you know, marked by his time inside. He had these new striking tattoos of figures like Arthur Ashe, Mao Zedong, and Che Guevara.
And his first comeback bout against Peter McNeely in August 1995 immediately showed that controversy generated unparalleled revenue. It was marketed simply as, "He's back."
And the event grossed over $96 million worldwide, setting new records for PPV viewership and revenue with 1.52 million buys.
One of the biggest events in combat sports history. And it lasted 89 seconds.
Exactly. The speed and the financial return immediately drew heavy criticism that his opponents were tomato cans, fighters who were intentionally chosen to ensure a rapid, guaranteed knockout.
Just to get a maximum financial return on his incarceration rather than, you know, genuine competition.
That momentum was enough to propel him back toward the titles, though. In March 1996, he defeated Frank Bruno again via TKO in the third round to regain the WBC title.
And in September 96, he took the WBA belt by defeating Bruce Seldon in the first round.
The Seldon fight was another controversy, wasn't it? Seldon was ridiculed in the media for seemingly collapsing from these, like, innocuous punches.
Yeah, there was widespread speculation that Seldon took a dive. The context is that Lennox Lewis, the legitimate contender, was allegedly paid $4 million to step aside, allowing Tyson to fight Seldon for a projected $30 million payday.
All to ensure the belts were back around Tyson's waist for the real money fight.
And that real money fight arrived in November 1996 against Evander Holyfield.
Holyfield was 34, viewed as being past his prime, and came into the bout as this massive underdog.
Tyson's camp, including promoter Don King, they reportedly saw Holyfield as an easy mark, just a placeholder, until they could arrange an even bigger payday against Lewis.
It was a catastrophic miscalculation. Holyfield, through discipline, strategy, and incredible conditioning, defeated Tyson by TKO in the 11th round.
And he became the second boxer ever to win a heavyweight championship belt three times.
Holyfield had found a technical way to neutralize Tyson that was almost reminiscent of the Douglas blueprint discipline and distance. Tyson's camp immediately launched these allegations that Holyfield used frequent, though accidental, headbutts.
Which set the stage for the most infamous rematch in history.
The Sound and the Fury in June 1997. It dwarfed the previous event in terms of infamy and money. It grossed $100 million.
Tyson earned $30 million and Holyfield got $35 million. The highest purses paid in boxing until 2007.
And here's where it gets unforgettable. The fight ended in the third round when Tyson was disqualified for doing what no boxer had ever done on that stage.
He bit Holyfield.
Yeah.
On both ears. The first bite was so severe it actually removed a piece of Holyfield's right ear, which was later discovered on the ring floor.
Tyson claimed his actions were direct retaliation for what he felt were Holyfield's persistent, unpenalized headbutts in both fights.
Regardless of the motivation, the consequences were devastating. The Nevada State Athletic Commission rescinded his boxing license, fined him $3 million, and withheld another $3 million from his purse.
$3 million gone with a single insane action. His license was eventually restored in October 1998, but in the meantime, he proved his ability to generate massive revenue outside of boxing.
That's right. In 1998, he appeared at WrestleMania 14 as the special guest enforcer for the main event and earned another $3 million for that one appearance.
He returned to the ring in 99, notably against Francois Botha, where critics definitively pointed out that he had completely abandoned the bob and weave defense. He was relying entirely on intimidating brute force.
And that fight was ill-tempered. Tyson allegedly tried to break Botha's arms during a tie-up before knocking him out in the fifth round.
But the legal and personal chaos was just relentless. In 1999, he was sentenced to a year in prison for assaulting two motorists in a traffic accident. He served 9 months.
The pattern of instability was clearly still dominant.
And when he returned in 2000, he delivered the post-fight tirade that encapsulated his chaotic persona perfectly. After knocking out Lou Severese in a lightning-fast 38 seconds, Tyson gave his notorious interview.
This is where he said, "I want your heart. I want to eat his children. Praise be to Allah." And then boldly called himself the best ever.
That speech was terrifying, unpredictable, and religiously charged. It just solidified his image as the absolute wild card of the sports world.
And that same year, the fight against Andrew Gallada, who famously quit on the stool after the second round, was changed to a no contest after Tyson failed a post-fight drug test for marijuana.
Finally, in June 2002, the world got the fight it had waited for since 1997. Lewis versus Tyson.
And Lennox Lewis, the dominant champion holding the WBC, IBF, IBO, and lineal titles, was just clearly the better man that night. Lewis dominated the action, winning by KO in the eighth round.
Commercially, though, this fight proved Tyson's unwavering drawing power, even in defeat. It generated $106.9 million from 1.95 million buys in the U.S.,
making it the highest-grossing pay-per-view event at the time. Yet the final act in the ring, it showed a degree of maturity. Tyson was reportedly respectful afterward, praising Lewis for his victory.
Following that loss to Lewis, Tyson's professional career was visibly in decline. It was characterized by this mix of brief flashes of brilliance and a growing lack of commitment to training.
His final professional victory came in February 2003 against Clifford Etienne in just 49 seconds of the first round.
Even this victory was overshadowed by his personal life, right? The sources noted that the lead-up to the fight was marred by rumors of Tyson's poor conditioning.
Yeah, claims he neglected training to party, and the distraction of him getting that brand-new, highly visible facial tattoo right before the bout.
And here we hit the most stunning contradiction of his career, the financial catastrophe.
Despite earning an estimated $30 million for several individual fights and accumulating a staggering fight, over $300 million throughout his professional career, Tyson filed for bankruptcy in August 2003.
He reported approximately $23 million in debt.
Wait. $300 million earned, yet $23 million in debt just a few years later. We need to spend some time here. How does that level of wealth just evaporate so quickly?
It's a combination of financial mismanagement, astronomical spending, and legal liabilities. The sources point to several factors. Excessive spending on mansions, luxury cars, jewelry, and even exotic pets.
He famously owned two white Bengal tigers.
Exactly. And on top of that, he was saddled with massive legal fees from his divorce, the sexual assault conviction, and numerous other lawsuits.
And crucially, the sources imply financial exploitation by others, particularly regarding his relationship with Don King.
Yes. Tyson later won a settlement against King for an alleged $100 million in embezzlement, though he only received a small fraction of that amount.
So the sheer volume of people drawing on his finances, combined with a lack of personal financial oversight and the drain of ongoing expensive litigation, It created a scenario where earning $300 million just wasn't enough to prevent insolvency.
The end of his professional run really underscored his decline. In 2004, he lost to journeyman Danny Williams by KO in the fourth round.
Then, his final professional fight in June 2005, he quit against journeyman Kevin McBride before the start of the seventh round.
He retired after the McBride loss, stating he had completely lost his passion for the sport.
which was tragically confirmed in his 2008 documentary. He confessed he fought McBride purely for a payday and did not anticipate or even really try to win. The motivation had shifted entirely from sporting glory to just economic necessity.
Outside of the ring, the addiction battles became brutally public. In 2007, he pleaded guilty to possession of cocaine and driving under the influence in Arizona.
And he admitted to having used cocaine that day and acknowledged his addiction to the drug. He served 24 hours in jail, followed by 3 years of probation.
And what's fascinating here, connecting back to the professional instability, is the staggering level of deception he used to navigate the doping regimes during his career peak.
Right. His 2013 autobiography, Undisputed Truth, revealed that he routinely used a fake penis, a Wizenator, to pass drug tests.
And he didn't just use tap water. The book explicitly details him using his then-wife Monica Turner's urine, and at times even his infant child's urine.
Wow.
To avoid detection for marijuana and cocaine use between 1997 and 2003.
That is a shocking admission. It provides incredible context regarding the pressure to compete while battling addiction and the lengths athletes will go to deceive drug testers.
It just underscores the chaos that was ongoing during his post-prison comeback years, and the vulnerability continued into his personal life.
In August 2013, he publicly admitted, "I'm on the verge of dying because I'm a vicious alcoholic," confessing that he had been lying about his sobriety.
He has since sought healthier avenues, though, including philosophy and diet. For 4 years, he adopted a vegan diet.
Though he is no longer strictly vegan, he claimed that red meat specifically made him very sick, and even speculated that the diet played a role in his past behavior. He said it might explain why he was so crazy before.
On the religious side, the media often misreported his conversion, while many believed he converted while he was incarcerated.
Tyson clarified that he became a Muslim before he ever entered prison in 1992. He later undertook the Islamic pilgrimage, Umrah, in both 2010 and 2022.
And in a strange, full-circle moment, he returned to the source of his very first fight, pigeons.
He took up pigeon racing, stating these birds were instrumental in getting him out of trouble. He claims to own hundreds, possibly even 1,000 of them.
It's a therapeutic hobby that connects him all the way back to that vulnerable youth defending his feathered friends.
His post-retirement career has really been defined by leveraging this potent cultural legacy. His first attempt, Mike Tyson's World Tour in 2006, featured exhibition bouts meant to pay off his debts.
But the poor reception after the first bout against Corey Sanders led to the rest of the tour being canceled.
A much more successful venture came in 2020 with the announcement of the Legends Only League, designed specifically to give retired professional athletes a platform to compete.
And the league's first flagship event, that exhibition match against Roy Jones Jr. in November 2020, was a commercial smash.
Yeah, despite being an 8-round draw, it was the highest-selling PPV event of 2020, garnering 1.6 million buys.
And of course, the most recent chapter, the sanctioned professional match against Jake Paul in November 2024. Despite being postponed due to Tyson's ulcer flare-up, it generated unprecedented buzz.
And even though Tyson lost via unanimous decision, the bout became the biggest boxing gate in U.S. history outside of Las Vegas. His name alone is still a guaranteed spectacle.
His cultural imprint is just enduring. He was the Ring Magazine's Fighter of the Year twice, is ranked 16th on their list of 100 greatest punchers,
and was inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame in 2011.
However, critics, even while acknowledging that terrifying 5-year period of peak performance, they often point to his lack of sustained excellence.
Right. A 2017 poll of experts by the Ring Magazine debating peak versus longevity ranked him only 9th of 20 heavyweight champions. So that debate over his short-lived dominance versus his overall career, it's part of his legacy.
Beyond the ring, he's a media personality, a fixture in popular culture, from film appearances in Rocky Balboa and The Hangover
to guest spots on Law & Order, Special Victims Unit, and hilariously voicing a fictionalized self in the animated Mike Tyson Mysteries. He is just omnipresent.
So what does this all mean when we put the pieces together? Mike Tyson remains one of the most recognized sports personalities globally, not just for his records, but because his entire life story is inherently dramatic.
And his controversial and ferocious persona ensures that decades after his prime, he remains a powerful box office draw.
We've traced the history from his 38 arrests as a youth and the development of that devastating peekaboo style under the late, great Customato.
Through the dizzying heights of the Sphinx 91-second obliteration and the subsequent crash of the Douglas upset.
We've examined the grim reality of the Washington trial, the infamous Holyfield bite that cost him millions, and the eventual financial collapse despite earning over $300 million.
The synthesis of all these sources, it just reveals this dramatic, unrelenting tension. Tyson's career is a microcosm of human extremes.
Yeah.
A raw, unparalleled athletic genius existing in constant conflict with a profound capacity for personal destruction and chaos.
His professional peak immediately preceded the onset of his greatest personal and legal turmoil. It makes his story one where triumph and turmoil are just inseparable partners.
We've seen Tyson transition from an intimidating force who rarely took a step back in the ring to a media personality who now draws massive gates against younger boxers like Jake Paul.
And given his own admissions of struggling with addiction and confessing he fought his final professional bout solely for a payday, this raises an important question for you, the listener, to explore.
When an athlete achieves such extreme fame that their personal struggles, their unpredictability, and controversy become their primary guaranteed revenue stream, a massive box office draw in and of themselves, does their ability to step away and transition into a quiet, normal life, free from the pressure of performance and chaos, become economically and culturally impossible?
Something to mull over until our next deep dive.